Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the 23rd video for the Old Testament Survey course. We're continuing our investigation of the historical books, and in this section, we're looking at the books of 1 and 2 Kings. And in terms of the background, we're talking about both 1 and 2 Kings together in this section, because just like 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings were originally written as one book, and they were later separated into two. And in this course, we'll look at both books of Kings together in order to help you get the big picture, and because there is no natural breaking point between these two books. You can see that the break between these books is right in the middle of one of the episodes. Now, I apologize if I'm inconsistent and sometimes refer to this as the one book of Kings and at other times refer to it as the two books of Kings. Both statements are true, and I hope this is not confusing. The name of this book is the Book of Kings, and I think this title is very appropriate for the book that narrates the various stories of the various kings and the events of their successive reigns. This book continues to narrate the history of the monarchy, the time when God's people were ruled by kings. Now, the author of the Book of Kings is anonymous. Possibly this is the same author who wrote Samuel, because the two books form a unified history of the monarchy in Israel. The author was almost certainly a prophet writing around the time of the exile, because this book ends at the exile and it tells the story from the prophetic perspective, which we'll discuss later. And in terms of the purpose why these books were written, as I mentioned, these books continue the story of the monarchy and they pick up from where the book of Samuel ended. These books continue the question of the fate of the kingship. Saul was bad. David was mostly good. What next? Will the nation live in scrub? Is it happily ever after? Or not? And I emphasize the or not part, because that is how it turned out. The story of Kings ends with God punishing his people with exile away from the promised land. You see, Kings was probably written at the time of the exile to show that the exile was deserved. It was written to highlight Deuteronomistic theology, especially the negative side. Remember, the primary history was written, at least partly, to explain the exile and defend God's punishment of his people as just and deserved. So some of the stories will be slanted to the negative. Israel, even with the best of advantages, was not able to keep the covenant. They need a savior. And we can accurately date the contents of this book. The period covered in the books of Kings is from the death of David around 970 BC until the exile around 530 BC. And if my math is correct, this book covers almost 4.5 centuries of history. And that is a long time and a lot of history all in this one book. Now, let's look at the organization of the books of Kings. The overall outline of the two books of Kings is divided into three main sections based upon the content of each section. The first section talks about the reign of King Solomon, David's son. The highlight of this section is the building and dedication of the temple in Jerusalem. Then the second section covers the divided kingdom. In this period, the unified kingdom under David and Solomon was divided into two separate nations. The southern kingdom contained two of the 12 tribes and was named after the dominant tribe of Judah. And the northern kingdom contained the other 10 tribes and was called Israel. Now that can be confusing because earlier the unified nation of 12 tribes was also called Israel, but try to keep these distinct in your mind. Sometimes these two nations were at enmity and war with each other. Sometimes they peacefully coexisted and were even allies at certain times. At the end of this period, the northern kingdom Israel was conquered by the Assyrian Empire, and it ceased to exist as a nation. And that brings us to the third section, which is Judah alone. The southern kingdom of Judah continued to exist for another century and a half, until it was conquered by Babylon and went into exile there. Now, there is a ton that happened in these two books, but the overall story can be divided into these three sections. Now, let's look at the content of Kings, starting with some key verses. First is 1 Kings 3, verses 1 through 3, and this says, Solomon made an alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married his daughter. He brought her to the city of David until he finished building his palace and the temple of Yahweh and the wall around Jerusalem. The people, however, were still sacrificing at the high places because a temple had not yet been built for the name of Yahweh. Solomon showed his love for Yahweh by walking according to the statutes of his father David, except that he offered sacrifices and burned incense on the high places. As we'll see in more detail later, the reign of Solomon was both good and bad. This conflicted character is represented in this verse, where it says that Solomon loved the Lord, which is true, but it also mentions the exception. Solomon's reign demonstrated the internal contradiction we still see in many Christian lives. There was genuine dedication to the Lord, but there was also compromise and conflicting loyalties. So pay attention to how that turned out for him. Next is 1 Kings 8, verses 22 through 30, and this says, Then Solomon stood before the altar of Yahweh in front of the whole assembly of Israel, spread out his hands toward heaven, and said, O Yahweh, God of Israel, there is no God like you in heaven above or on earth below. You who keep your covenant of love with your servants, who continue wholeheartedly in your way. You have kept your promise to your servant David, my father. With your mouth you have promised, and with your hand you have fulfilled it, as it is today. Now, Yahweh, God of Israel, keep for your servant David, my father, the promise you made to him when you said, You shall never fail to have a man to sit before me on the throne of Israel, if only your sons are careful in all that they do to walk before me as you have done. And now, O God of Israel, let your word that you promised your servant David, my father, come true. But will God really dwell on earth? The heavens, even the highest heavens, cannot contain you, how much less this temple I have built. Yet give attention to your servant's prayer and his plea for mercy, O Yahweh my God. Hear the cry of the prayer that your servant is praying in your presence this day. May your eyes be open toward this temple night and day, this place of which you said, My name shall be there, so that you will hear the prayer your servant prays toward this place. Hear the supplication of your servant and of your people Israel when they pray toward this place. Hear from heaven your dwelling place, and when you hear, forgive. Now these verses are Solomon's prayer at the dedication of the temple. It was an acknowledgement of God's greatness and his faithfulness and blessing to his people. And it highlighted the fact that the temple cannot really contain the infinite God. But it also recognized that God had chosen and promised to put his name and presence in that particular place. And it drew on the promise of the Davidic covenant. And so the temple was a location to focus prayer and the dedication of the Lord's people to him, because it was the place that God chose to manifest his presence for his people Israel. Then 1 Kings 8, 56 through 61 says, Praise be to Yahweh, who has given rest to his people Israel just as he promised. Not one word has failed of all the good promises he gave through his servant Moses. May Yahweh our God be with us as he was with our fathers. May he never leave us nor forsake us. May he turn our hearts to him to walk in all his ways and to keep the commandments, decrees, and regulations he gave our fathers. And may these words of mine, which I've prayed before Yahweh, be near to Yahweh our God day and night, that he may uphold the cause of his servant and the cause of his people Israel according to each day's need, so that all the peoples of the earth may know that Yahweh is God and that there is no other. But your hearts must be fully committed to Yahweh our God, to live by his decrees and obey his commands, as at this time. This passage was also at the dedication of the temple, and it was Solomon's charge to the people. Notice that he emphasized that none of God's promises had failed, and he prayed for God's blessing on the people to help them keep his commands. And the purpose is so that all the nations of the earth will know that he is Yahweh. And finally, he charged the people to remain faithful to the covenant. Next is 1 Kings 9, verses 4 through 7, in which God was speaking to Solomon, and he said, "As for you, if you walk before me in integrity of heart and uprightness, as David your father did, and do all I command and observe my decrees and laws, I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever, as I promised David your father when I said, 'You shall never fail to have a man on the throne of Israel.' But if you or your sons turn away from me and do not observe the commands and decrees I have given you and go off to serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land I have given them and will reject this temple I have consecrated for my name. Israel will then become a byword and an object of ridicule among all peoples." This passage was immediately after the dedication of the temple. It is both a promise and a warning. It is classic Deuteronomistic theology. If Solomon and the nation are faithful, it will go well, and Solomon will experience all the blessings of the Davidic covenant for himself. But if they are unfaithful, the nation will be destroyed. Then 1 Kings 18:21 says, "Elijah went before the people and said, 'How long will you waver between two opinions? If Yahweh is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him.' But the people said nothing." In this famous passage, Elijah was setting up a contest between God and the false gods on Mount Carmel. He challenged the people to get off the fence, either wholeheartedly follow God or choose other gods. This is like the challenge that Joshua gave the Israelites to choose this day whom you will serve. You see, God does not want divided loyalties and half-hearted service, and God will not share affections with false gods. Remember, the first commandment is, "You shall have no other gods beside me." And remember the fact that God is a jealous God, and rightfully so, because he is the only true God. All the other supposed gods are just false man-made idols. And so, when the people were falling into idolatry in Elijah's time, God confronted them and challenged them to clearly make the choice and live with the consequences of that choice. And the same could be said about many occasions described in the books of Kings. And then later, 2 Kings 17:18 through 20 says, "So Yahweh was very angry with Israel and removed them from his presence. Only the tribe of Judah was left, and even Judah did not keep the commands of Yahweh their God. They followed the practices Israel had introduced. Therefore, Yahweh rejected all the people of Israel. He afflicted them and gave them into the hands of plunderers until he thrust them from his presence." This passage summarized the destruction of the northern kingdom and gives the theological reason why it happened. The people were idolaters and had broken covenant with Yahweh, and therefore he kicked them out of his land, out of his presence, just like he had warned that would happen if they did what they did. None of God's promises failed in this respect either. And then over a century later, in the story is 2 Kings 23:26 through 27, which says, "Nevertheless, Yahweh did not turn away from the heat of his fierce anger, which burned against Judah because of all that Manasseh had done to provoke him to anger. So Yahweh said, 'I will remove Judah also from my presence as I removed Israel, and I will reject Jerusalem, the city I chose, and this temple about which I said, there shall my name be.'" This passage gives a similar summary of the destruction of the southern kingdom. And special mention is made of King Manasseh, whose rule was so evil that God had sworn to reject his people and his place. And God highlighted that he was rejecting Jerusalem, the place where he had put his name and presence. He was removing his name and presence from that place and was removing Judah from his presence because of their sin. And then finally is 2 Kings 24, 1 through 4. During Jehoiakim's reign, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, invaded the land, and Jehoiakim became his vassal for 3 years. But then he changed his mind and rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. The Lord sent Babylonian, Aramean, Moabite, and Ammonite raiders against him. He sent them to destroy Judah in accordance with the word of the Lord proclaimed by his servants the prophets. Surely these things happened to Judah according to the Lord's command, in order to remove them from his presence because of the sins of Manasseh and all he had done, including the shedding of innocent blood. For he had filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, and the Lord was not willing to forgive. This passage tells of the capture and destruction of Judah and Jerusalem for the same reasons as given in the previous key verses. God had warned them many times that they would be destroyed if they were unfaithful in idolatry, and that is exactly what happened. So at the end of the books of Kings, both the northern kingdom Israel and the southern kingdom Judah were destroyed because of unfaithfulness to God and breaking the covenant. The northern kingdom completely disappeared, and the southern kingdom was taken into exile into Babylon. These key verses give us some highlights of the many events covered in the two books of Kings. Now, let's look in more detail at each of the sections of Kings, starting with the reign of Solomon. The highlight of Solomon's reign was the building of the temple. The temple in Jerusalem served the same function as the tabernacle, the presence of God among his people. In fact, the temple basically was the tabernacle, just now made permanent. The floor plan is exactly like the tabernacle, except bigger, and instead of movable materials, it was made of permanent precious stones. And when it was completed, the temple was an architectural marvel that displayed God's greatness for the surrounding nations. And the manifest presence of God in a cloud filled the temple as a demonstration of his presence there, just like had happened when the tabernacle was first built. And the temple was dedicated with much ceremony as the place of God's presence, the place where he had placed his name, the place to pray, sacrifice, and meet with him. The dedication of God's temple in Jerusalem is probably the high point of all of Israelite history. This is the most blessed, the most prosperous, the most faithful, the most peaceful time in all of the history of the Old Testament since the Garden of Eden. God had done so many things to bless his people. He gave them great promises through Abraham, their forefather, and he had fulfilled all those promises. He rescued them from Egypt and brought them into the land. He gave them peace and prosperity. He gave them his righteous instructions and various leaders to lead them. And he had put his very presence among them in the glorious place he had chosen and caused to be built. So before we move on with the story, let's pause to appreciate how blessed they were and how good God had been to them. But unfortunately, the story does not stay at that high point. Remember that Solomon was warned at the end of the temple dedication. He and Israel could go either way, good or bad. That means that we should look at King Solomon as a leader and how he influenced Israel. So, what do you typically think about Solomon and his leadership? Was he a good guy or a bad guy? Was he a good king or a bad king? Well, we've already seen the contradictory character of Solomon's reign. In one sense, he led them to the height of the blessing and prosperity of the kingdom of Israel. Remember this diagram? The earthly kingdom reached the height of its prosperity and power at the time of Solomon. The earthly kingdom reached the height of its territorial expansion at the time of Solomon. It is said that they looked down on silver because gold was so plentiful in the prosperity of Solomon's time. And Solomon was the epitome of wisdom. People came from far countries to hear the wisdom of Solomon, which was given by God. And it is said that Solomon loved and worshiped the Lord. And yet, in another sense, it was the beginning of the downfall of the kingdom of Israel. By the end of his reign, Solomon led the nation into idolatry. He set up temples for other gods to please his many foreign wives. Like Saul, Solomon started so well but ended badly. And for the rest of the primary history, the nation was on a slow descent away from God and the blessings that God gives. Now, it was more like a roller coaster with many ups and downs throughout that history. But the overall trajectory of the rest of Kings is definitely downward. Now, I want to be clear that I'm not saying that all of this was Solomon's fault. Every king after him and every person in Israel was responsible for their own faithfulness or lack thereof. However, Solomon was the one in charge when the direction of God's people changed toward the negative. And that leads us to ask, how did that happen? Well, when we pay attention to the narrative technique that the author of Kings used to tell Solomon's story, we learn some important truths. First, notice the way that the author described the power and prosperity of Solomon. In chapters 10 and 11, he highlights how Solomon had amassed huge amounts of gold, how he traded in horses, and how he married multiple wives to secure alliances with the surrounding nations. And by the way this is told, it seems like the author was highlighting how blessed and prosperous Solomon was. And I admit that for the longest time, that is how I read this account. But then I remembered this passage while I was reading in Deuteronomy chapter 17, where God warned through Moses that the future king was not to amass horses, wives, or gold, nor put his trust in these things, because they would become his downfall. The writer of Kings knew the Torah and pointed out that Solomon did those very things that Deuteronomy had warned against, so that a reader who is familiar with God's word would notice what this was actually saying about Solomon. Solomon did those very things that God said Israel's kings should not do. And second, I want to point out a large-scale sandwich structure. And I do want to give credit for this to Bruce Waltke. The way that the author organized the first 11 chapters of Kings highlights the reason for Solomon's failure. It started with a prophet intervening to make Solomon king, and it ended with a prophet promising Jeroboam would rule over part of the divided kingdom. Next, Solomon got rid of rivals to his rule, and next to last, God raised up rivals to Solomon, including Jeroboam. Next, Solomon was faithful and received wisdom. And next from last, Solomon engaged in blatant idolatry. Next, Solomon used his wisdom to judge justly. And next from last, Solomon used Israel for forced labor, enriching and glorifying himself. Next, Solomon prepared to build the temple. And next from last, Solomon dedicated the temple. But he was warned by God of the punishment if he was unfaithful. Next, Solomon built the temple, and next from last, Solomon furnished the temple. Now, I hope you see that this structure of the narrative is intentional and is pointing to something important. And right in the middle is the story of Solomon building rival buildings to the temple. Solomon built his own palace and a palace for his foreign wife. The temple took 7 years to build, and these rival buildings took 13 years. In other words, the author subtly points out that in addition to working on the temple for God's glory, Solomon also had other loyalties which seemed to rival or even be above God. Solomon cared about these other things as much or more as he cared about honoring the Lord. And so the foundation of Solomon's reign was already showing cracks long before the house fell down. And as I mentioned, by the end of his reign, Solomon had given in to idolatry and was serving foreign gods in addition to serving the Lord. But it started with divided loyalties and having rival allegiances, which ultimately led to serving rival gods. And the Lord had clearly promised punishment for this kind of idolatry. And that leads into the next section of the divided kingdom. I already mentioned that the one nation was divided into two nations, Judah in the south and Israel in the north. And this happened right after the death of Solomon, though it was put in motion during his lifetime. And we need to ask the question, why was the kingdom divided? Well, on the one hand, it was God's purpose, promised as punishment for Solomon's idolatry. God took away 10 tribes from Solomon's son, and yet left him 2 tribes because of his promise that David would always have a descendant on the throne. On the other hand, the nation was divided because of the pride and stupidity of Rehoboam, Solomon's son. He refused to listen to the wise older advisors and only listened to his peers, who did not yet have the wisdom of experience. And a third factor, which was also a result of the first two things, was a rebellion led by a man named Jeroboam. 10 tribes rebelled against Solomon's son, led by Jeroboam, and they formed a separate nation. Jeroboam was instructed at this time by God to do this, and he was also clearly commanded to be faithful to God's Torah. And God offered him a dynasty similar to the Davidic covenant if Jeroboam were to be faithful. But Jeroboam was unfaithful and idolatrous. And he did this for political reasons and because he did not trust in God's word of promise to him. Therefore, Jeroboam set up an alternate religion using golden calf idols, which should sound familiar. He placed those idols at 2 strategic places in the northern kingdom in order to be an alternative to the temple in Jerusalem. And so Jeroboam led the northern kingdom into blatant idolatry from the start. And then throughout the rest of these books, we see the stories of the rest of the kings of Judah and Israel told in overlapping chronological order. And each story of each king is told in a regular pattern, a cycle, which typically had these features. First is an introduction, which has such things as when the king began to reign, how old he was when he became king, and sometimes it tells his mother's name. And then is the most important part of the cycle, the evaluation sentence. This is where God tells whether they were a good or a bad king, whether they did good in the eyes of the Lord or did evil. The southern kings are compared to David. Either it says they were good like David or they were not good like David. And the northern kings are compared with Jeroboam. Either they were evil like Jeroboam or they were even more evil than Jeroboam. There were no good kings in the northern kingdom according to God's valuation. And then the cycle tells the events of their reign, and near the end, it often gives a reference to other documents which no longer exist, where the people of that day could find more information about their reign. And then finally, there's an account of their death, burial, and their successor. Now, this pattern is told in the normal way for each story of each king. So make sure to notice whenever the author deviates from that pattern. And one example is the story of King Ahab. His narrative is huge because it is interrupted by the stories of Elijah and Elisha in the middle of his reign, which shows that he was so bad that God had to send these prophets to deal with him. Now, in this survey, we just don't have the time to go through each king. We'll just list them and notice if they were a good king or a bad king. And I'll remind you that this is a long history with ups and downs, good kings and bad kings, good times and bad times. First, I'll list the kings of the northern kingdom Israel. Here are all these kings listed in order and with an indication whether they were good or bad. And I've also color-coded these names by dynasty. In other words, the kings whose names are the same color are all father to son passing down the kingship. But notice how often the dynasties changed, and they usually changed by assassination. One king was killed, and his killer took over as king. And some kings lasted less than a week before they were killed. The northern kings were acting just like the kings of the surrounding nations, cutthroat politics to get and keep power for themselves. And notice that all the kings of the northern kingdom are evaluated as bad kings because they all followed the idolatry of Jeroboam. And the ones who weren't like Jeroboam were even worse, worshiping the gods of the Canaanites. Now, we'll look at a list of the kings of the southern kingdom, Judah. All of these kings, except one, were direct descendants of David. Notice also that 8 were good kings and 11 were bad. And I've notated 2 who were exceptionally bad. One is the wicked queen Athaliah. She was not descended from David, but she unlawfully took over the kingdom for a time. And she almost wiped out the descendants of David. But of course, she was not successful, and she soon received her just punishment. The second horrible ruler is Manasseh. The Book of Kings states that he was so bad in his wickedness, idolatry, and cruelty that God determined to judge and destroy the southern kingdom. The writer of Kings singled him out as the very worst king. Each king's reign was described in this book, but again, we just don't have time to look at them all individually. And I also need to take a bit of a digression to look at 2 items of international politics at that time, which have a direct bearing on this story. The first is the Assyrian Empire that started in Mesopotamia. This empire had its capital first at Assur and later at the city of Nineveh. This empire reached its height in the 7th century BC, and they were absolutely brutal and wicked in their conquest. And this empire conquered the northern kingdom in 722 through 721 BC. And the second is the Babylonian Empire. It had its capital in Babylon in Mesopotamia. It rebelled against and conquered the Assyrian Empire, and it reached its height in the 6th century BC. And the Babylonian Empire conquered the southern kingdom in 587-586 BC. Now, speaking of conquest, let's look at the punishment and destruction of the two kingdoms. Both kingdoms were eventually conquered as a direct result of their infidelity to God. Remember that the books of Kings were written to describe the reason for the exile. So the reasons are highlighted throughout this book in its record of the many idolatries of Israel and Judah. And it directly explains the reasons for the captivity by referencing the verses in the Torah where God threatened to kick them out of the land that he had given them if they break the covenant. And it compares the requirements of the covenant with the actual behavior of the people during this time, in order to clearly show that they had broken the covenant in many ways. Let me give you just one example. In 2 Kings chapter 17, it gives the theological reason why the northern kingdom was conquered. Chapter 17, verse 7 says, "All this took place because the Israelites had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of Egypt from under the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. They worshipped other gods." Please notice that this is almost a direct quote of the first commandment from Exodus 20, verses 2 through 3, which says, "I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me." God said, "Don't worship other gods," and they worshiped other gods. And the rest of 2 Kings chapter 17 continues in a similar manner, going down the list of how God commanded Israel to live, and then showing how Israel had broken every one of these commandments. Not only that, but God had sent prophets to call them back to faithfulness, but they ignored and or persecuted God's prophets. And that does bring us to the last item that I want to highlight from the content of the book of Kings, and this is the prophets. There are a number of prophets whose ministry is described in these books. However, I want to mention just two, Elijah and Elisha, whose ministry set the standard for the other prophets. Now, please don't confuse these two because their names are so similar. I will try to enunciate to distinguish them. First is Elijah. Elijah stood against the idolatry of King Ahab and his wicked wife Jezebel, and he arranged the contest at Mount Carmel. He challenged the people that they cannot serve the gods of Ahab and Yahweh at the same time. Only one is really God, and they should find out which and then serve him wholeheartedly. And in this contest, God dramatically proved himself to be the true God and proved that the false gods were impotent because they were nothing. The point of this whole episode is that Yahweh is God, and there should be no idolatry in Israel because there is no other God. After that, wicked Queen Jezebel threatened Elijah's life because of this, and he fled into hiding. And he despaired until God reminded him that he had 7,000 people who had not given in to idolatry. This faithful remnant of God's obedient people is where God is working, both in Elijah's time and in ours. And finally, Elijah did not die, but he was taken into heaven in a whirlwind. And the prophetic calling was passed to Elisha. Elisha did many miracles that foreshadow the ministry of Jesus, and Elisha also impacted the surrounding nations. And the later writing prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah and all the rest also ministered in the time of the kings, but we'll discuss them later when we look at the prophetic books. The point of all the prophets in the book of Kings is that even when the human kings were unfaithful to God, God was still the real king over his people, and he often overruled the human kings by his word through prophets and through his arranging of events, even huge events of international politics, in order to do his will. This is still God's history. He is working out his perfect plan for the universe, even when human kings and nations demonstrate that they cannot keep God's covenant. Now, let's look at the theological themes of the books of Kings. The first is Deuteronomistic theology. And I hope you've already noticed this theme from what we've already discussed. And I hope you don't need an explanation of this theme at this point. But I just want to point out that the author uses this idea to tell the story of the kings and explain the reason for the exile. The second theme is the prophetic perspective. This is the mindset of the prophets, but also describes the way that the author of Kings tells the story, because he is a prophet and has the prophetic perspective. The prophetic perspective means seeing everything from God's perspective, seeing things how God sees things, and evaluating everything by God's standards, not by human standards. This means judging value and success according to God's values, from God's perspective, not from the worldly perspective of our society. And in the book of Kings, this is primarily concerned with covenant faithfulness and loyalty to God. And this is often displayed by faithfulness to the temple and faithfulness to the Israelite religion and the Torah. And that means no idolatry. And David and Jeroboam are used as measuring standards for the good and the bad, respectively. The prophetic perspective means asking the most important thing is, am I faithful to God or not? Is this king faithful to God or not? So, how does this work out in our lives? Ask yourself, what is the most important standard of success in your life? Is it money? Is it fashion or good looks? Is it good grades or popularity? If you listen to the media around us, the most important things are to be good-looking, rich, famous, and powerful. But that's not where God is. That's not what is important to God. Now, that doesn't mean that these things are all bad. But according to God, the most important things are character and faithfulness to God and God's ways. Nothing is more important than this. And this is how our lives will ultimately be evaluated. Remember how Solomon's divided loyalties contributed to his downfall? So be very careful and keep this concept in mind when making decisions about what is really important to you. Try to make your priorities conform to God's priorities. That is what it means to have the prophetic perspective, like the Book of Kings. Now, let's review. First, we'll review the three sections of Kings. They are Solomon, divided kingdom, and Judah alone. And let's review the two items of international politics. And they are Assyria conquered Israel around 721 BC, and Babylon conquered Judah around 586 BC. So remember the nation that conquered, the nation that was conquered, and the date. Now, these are the only two dates that I will insist you learn in this course, but I want you to know all this information for reference. And finally, let's review the theological themes. They are Deuteronomistic theology and prophetic perspective. Please make sure you understand each of these terms and have an idea of how they are worked out in the books of Kings and how they apply to your own life. Now, as usual, there's a ton of stuff from the books of Kings that we had to leave out, but I hope you get the big picture idea of the overall content, message, and significance of 1st and 2nd Kings. And I pray that you've learned more what God was doing in that time and what he wants from his people both then and today. In the next section, we'll continue with the books of 1st and 2nd Chronicles. Thanks for watching.